The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 11th of June, 2021. On the podcast today, Bill Brodie-Good, CEO and Technical Director of Alien Metals, discusses the termination of the Donovan 2 earning agreement with Capstone Mining Corporation. Plus, Joe Solomon, Managing Director of Oilex, talks about the sale and purchase agreement to acquire 100% of the Cambay project. And Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, gives his view on the market and stocks to watch, including Michelmersh, Avingtrans, Avacta, Merck, Totally, Source Bio, Roslyn Data, and Truefin. Plus, as always, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs too. You can check out both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you can also see lots for the content. In fact, there's a Traders Cafe. There's Zach Meir. What's he looking at? Braveheart, Cadence, IQAI, Gulf Keystone, Metal Tiger, Mode Global, Mobility One, Novaside, Prospect Energy, Staffline, and Warpaint. There's also a video there, Macro Investing Masterclass with Paul Hill and some of the big names in investing, James Athey, who else there, Colin McLean, James Bevan. There's also articles on the front page there, Guild Esports, one there, Zephyr Energy, Powerhouse Energy, lots of content there, and of course, the COVID-19 Index. Biggest rise of the day. In fact, just announced an RNS, Avacta Group. We discussed this on the podcast with Paul, up 13% at 248. Biggest fall of the day, Synergin down 2% to 151. Check out that and all that content at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Bill Brodie-Good, CEO and Technical Director of Alien Metals. UFO is the ticker there. Bill, thanks for joining me.
Justin, nice to catch up again.
Yeah, I saw the news out yesterday, a termination of Donovan 2 earning agreement. And of course, the market didn't take that well, but it's good to get you on to explain further, because I know, you know, RNSs are black and white, and sometimes they're written in a, they have to be written in a way that sometimes I find hard to read. And that's why I started doing podcasts. I thought, let's talk to people. Normal dialogue. That's how the world goes round. So it's nice to get you on to explain what's happening there. Before we talk about that, Bill, though, like I said, you know, Donovan 2 is not the only thing going on. There's lots of things going on. So just explain, if you could, what Alien Metals is all about.
Well, so thanks, Justin, and I agree 100% what you say. It is very black and white. It's a bit like looking at a map and looking at point, you know, X marks the spot, but yeah. It's not sometimes quite as black and white as that, mm-hmm. or if it's in colour. But look, Alien Metals, you know, we're a mineral exploration development company. We've got several projects. In two main jurisdictions, Mexico and Australia, so fantastic jurisdictions. We're doing exploration. Exploration has its ups and downs. You know, this recent announcement is, it's just part of the process.
So explain what's going on there, first of all, with Capstone and Donovan 2. Explain what the relationship was and what was happening there, if you could.
Okay, well, look, the middle of last year, you know, we've been doing a little bit of work on Donovan 2. We've done some geophysics. We had some excellent samples that we've taken with over 3% copper. So we were very encouraged by the project, and actually Capstone came to us and said, look, we like the project. It looks great. Good location. It sits about 20 k's from the Tech Resources San Nicolas resource, which is over 100 million tons, I think, at just over 1% copper. VMS system, these VMS volcanic massive sulfide, they occur in like clusters. It's not like you get one and you don't see another one for 1,000 miles. You get them like... you know, they pop up here and there like mushrooms in the rain. Mm-hmm. So we're very excited. They came on board. They said, right, well, we did the earning agreement. So they basically took it on, took on the project, took on the funding, did some geophysics, So quite detailed geophysics last year, and then did a maiden drilling program this year. They drilled 7 holes. As from the plan in the RNS, it's not the clearest, but it does show 7 individual holes in sort of different directions, targeting very specific points from a geophysical targets. Mm-hmm. And their results, well, as you saw the table, which is really all we've had to date on the actual assay results, other than a small, reasonable intersection in hole 1, nothing significant. And so Capstone, I think there's a combination there. So they felt, corporately, they told me they're going more greenfield. So they're changing a little bit. You know, the big bosses have said, right, we don't want to do so much sort of grassroots type projects. We'd rather put our funds into more advanced projects. So that's one reason. Mm-hmm. I think that's the main reason, because as I said in the RNS, and as they've said to us, it's not exhaustive. It's a maiden drilling program. It's 7 holes on a couple of very large targets. Yeah. It's what it is, and it happens. But significantly, we now, as a company, we now inherit all that great work they did. So we've got all the new geophysics they did. We've got 7 holes they've drilled. We've got all the core. We can go back and look at that. We can see where, you know, geologically, what the core has intercepted. Obviously, they're going to send us that information, but we will physically have the material to look at ourselves. And, you know, no offense to anyone, any of my colleagues in the exploration world, but obviously sometimes you look at it and you have with a different pair of eyes, and you might go, oh, actually that might be a different, you know, they might have missed a trick or whatever it might be.
And you say, exploring 7 holes, you know, you're exploring at the moment, and that's the nature of it, isn't it? That's what you do.
Well, absolutely. Maiden drilling programs. Remember, Donovan 2, apart from a little bit of surface mapping, you got to remember it's sort of a like a big arable field. Mm-hmm. Apart from a little bit of surface mapping and this one bit of work in this old water well, where we got some really good samples from, and which is a great asset to have in the project. Mm-hmm. 7 and some geophysics, 7 holes in 7 directions in 7 places is it does sound like a movie, that, but it's a maiden program, and maiden programs often are frustrating. If you go look at the history of exploration and discovery of ore bodies, it's not the first operator, it's sometimes not the second, it might be the third party that hits the ground that has a different feel, or you know, they get a prospector out and he goes, actually, you should be looking over here under this tree rather than under that tree. So actually, we're very excited. We've got, you know, we get the project back, so it's now back into the fold 100%. Mm-hmm. We have all this new information that we then reinterpret, add to the pot. We're going to do some reinterpretation of the geophysics. We're going to do a bit more work on the ground, maybe do some geochemistry, certain types of geochemistry that are quite interesting for these sort of terrains that see a little bit through the sort of surface arable lands and things like that. We've got some information already from the San Nicolas deposit in terms of how it was discovered, its relationship to certain geophysical tests that were done. And we're going to sort of tie those in a bit more. And in one level, it's like, oh, that's a shame that Capstone aren't sort of funding and supporting it. But on the other hand, we now have it back in the fold. We've got some very good ideas. And of course, I'd like to think there's other parties out there who might be saying, well, actually, we'd like a go. So
yeah, well, it's the right commodities, let's be honest. Copper's not getting any cooler, is it?
Well, no, absolutely. I mean, copper's a fantastic commodity to be in. And don't forget the gold credits there as well.
Yeah.
So really, it's...
So essentially, you know, it's a disappointment for you, frustrating temporarily, but like I said, you're still quite excited about this project, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I'd like to think it invigorates Alien and hopefully gives that extra spark because we, you know, the other projects in Mexico, the silver projects, you know, we're on the cusp of getting those permits, and I'm hoping that this will, like, you know, rev everything up and say, right, you know, hit the ground running and get those back up on track as well. So I think it's an opportunity, even though it's frustrating in one sense, and now sort of we're funding it for the time being, but we have that ability still. We have some good funding still in the bank. So it's not like we suddenly are scratching our heads.
Yeah, exactly. So going forward here, what's the next thoughts, next plans with this then, this project?
We're just getting, so Capstone, and they've been fantastic. They're going to provide all the data, so we get all the results, all the logging, the geological logging from the work, all the geophysical stuff. We already, our geologist down there, Jose Luis, he's been back onto the ground. He's been down that well again. I think you saw in the RNS, the last picture, there's that fantastic sample taken from the well again. And we're going back to that, and we've got a couple of ideas for where we should drill. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at possibly doing two or three more drill holes initially. As I said, maybe do some soil geochemistry, maybe get the geophysics reinterpreted. You know, sometimes a fresh look is a useful thing to have. Mm-hmm. See where, you know, get on with it, really. Copper's great. Copper's fantastic. And we still believe this, you know, Donovan 2 has great potential to host something significant.
Yeah, decent commodity, decent jurisdition. Like I say, it's not the only project going on. So let's get three reasons, Paul, Bill, why someone who looking at early metals now sees a little dip here, and why you think they should hit that follow button on your page and add early metals to their watch list, please.
Well, I think as we just mentioned, you know, commodities, our core commodities, the projects we're working on are copper, silver, it's a great commodity as well, and iron ore. Let's not forget that we have some fantastic news has been coming out of our iron ore project in the Pilbara. We just finished that drilling program. So commodities, locations, you know, Mexico, awesome mining jurisdiction, great. You know, we've got a good team down there going really well. And we were chatting early, but I'm hoping to even get there myself soon. As long as there's not too many prohibitive restrictions in place, we all know that's still quite tricky. But I think now it warrants getting down there and really geeing everybody up and getting back on the ground. And the team, you know, I've got a great team in Australia. We've just done a very successful follow up on the iron ore. We've got a team hitting the ground in about 10 days' time on Elizabeth Hill, which again is silver, but also a nickel, copper, PGEs. I mean, PGEs are a fantastic commodity. So, you know, quite a combination. And a dip has happened, but I'd like to think that things are going to improve. And you know, we're just going to keep doing what we do best, which is, I'd like to think, cost-effective, efficient exploration to add value to all our projects.
Excellent stuff. Marvellous. Bill, thanks for that, fella. And hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Yeah. I hope so, Justin. You take care. Thanks for your time.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Joe Solomon, Managing Director of OilX. OEX is ticker there. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. Great to be with you.
Yeah, you too, Joe. And you've announced significant news and progress on the Cambay project. Before we get into that, you know, for people not familiar with the company, just give us a brief summary as to what OilX is all about, please, Joe.
Yes, OilX, we are an oil and gas company, an explorer producer headquartered in Australia, in Perth, but we are listed both on the ASX and the AIM market. And in fact, a lot of our trading, most of our trading and most of our shareholding is in the UK as opposed to Australia. Yeah. So our focus is on India and the UK.
Okay, cool. And you just announced the sales and purchase agreement whereby OLX is buying GSPC's 55% equity in the Cambay PSC and will hold 100% ownership and control of the project. Could you provide some background around this, please, Joe?
Sure thing. Our shareholders will know a lot about this because they've been long-suffering. This has taken some time to get to. And during that time, the company has been in more or less a holding pattern over the last couple of years with our headline project in India. It's called the Cambay Project. The project has really been stalled. But after extensive discussion and negotiation with our Indian partner, GSPC, we are now purchasing their 55% equity, which means that they will exit the project. OLX will have 100% and control of what is a recognized gas condensate project. The purchase price for the 55% equity is US dollars, $2.2 million. We believe that's a very good purchase price. We've recently announced a capital raising, which provides the funding for the purchase. And the resolution of this means that the company can now go ahead to restart on the project and focus on a pilot program to drill new wells to test gas flows.
Yeah. Well, take us through that. Just remind us of the specifics there and the potential of the Cambay gas project, if you could, Joe.
The Cambay project is situated in the heart of one of the most industrialized states of India, in Gujarat. And it's in the center of one of the main oil and gas producing basins, the Cambay Basin. Mm. In fact, the PSC is one of the original onshore licenses in India. And it's where one of India's first discoveries occurred. It's had many wells drilled into it, so there's a lot of knowledge associated around it. And during something like 30 years of exploration, there have been a number of phases of exploration and production. And there has been both oil and gas production from a number of reservoirs. Our focus now, and has been for some time, on a known gas accumulation, a reservoir in tight Eocene siltstones at around 2,700 metres depth. Gas has been produced from this reservoir, albeit up to this time at relatively low rates, but we know the gas is present. And our efforts over the last few years, while the project has been stalled, have been directed at establishing the optimal drilling and stimulation program, which will increase production rates. Our ultimate aim is to aggregate sufficient production from a number of wells so that we can produce into the main gas distribution trunk lines, the high-pressure lines that carry gas across India. And that means we'll effectively replace imported LNG and achieve LNG parity pricing. Back in 2015, 2016, a third-party expert resource study estimated volumes of almost 1 trillion cubic feet of recoverable gas, along with 61 million barrels of condensate in the contingent category. So significant volumes. And for some time now, we've been preparing for an initial drilling program consisting of two vertical wells as a pilot program, which will kickstart redevelopment of the field. And our specific aim for that will be to drill the wells and determine gas flow rates, both pre and post reservoir stimulation, so that on success, we can move into the already government approved field development plan.
Yeah, absolutely. So all go. So 100% ownership. What's next? What happens here? Where do you go from here then, Joe?
Well, we expect the government of India will ratify the transfer of the 55% equity to OLX over the next months. That's something that needs to happen, obviously. This will provide us with all the clearances that we need to proceed with the planning and preparation activities to get the drilling program moving in the field. The details of what need to happen going forward, we've reduced our headcount, so we need to reappoint personnel to affect the program. We need to procure services. We need to work on the detailed planning and the management systems for the drilling program. At the same time, we've been working on our project in the East Irish Sea, and we see a lot of potential for companies like ours, both in the UK and in India. In the UK, as such a progressive government regulator, we have access to huge volumes of data. We know about the production there. There's a real depth of experience and knowledge. There's real existing facilities. And our overall plan there is to continue our work both in India and in the UK to bring about the long-awaited turnaround for the company. We're in the strongest position that we have been for some years, and we're now able to move forward. So, you know, many thanks to our long-standing shareholders and stakeholders who have held their patience through these challenging times.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. It's good to get on the front foot here moving forward. So if someone's listening to this, Joe, likes the sound of the progress you're making but are not yet following the story, as always, if you could, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add Oilex to their watch list, please.
Okay. In India, we have a project with very large gas and condensate resources, a high-value project. We're set. We now have control, again, of that project. And the third reason is we're in the strongest position that we have been for some time. And we've just gone through fundraising. So all of those 3 points put us at a point where we can move forward from here.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Joe, good to chat to you. And like I said, lots going on. So hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now and in full technical, he's a guy I learn something from every week, even if it's just the odd sleeping patterns he has, but it's more than that normally. It's Paul Hill, full-time analyst, full-time equity investor. You're right, Paul.
Yeah, morning, Justin. Well, let's turn the tables a bit. Just learning something from you. Did you manage to catch a mackerel on your holidays down in Devon on the coast?
Well, I told my wife about what you said. She booked straight away on the phone, booked, and we got on the boat there. We went out there. It was like 10 of us on a little boat, and me and my two sons and my wife was with the dog at the beach hut. And we were out for an hour and a half. Like that. No one caught anything.
Right? Oh, no!
Apart from my son, Monty, the youngest on the boat, and he caught this odd fish, I don't know what it's called. He called it Duncan, but had to throw it back in. But that was it, one fish. And the guy said, it's very odd. He said, the thing is, he said, you're about 3 weeks too late. He said, because we've had a bit of a cold May. It's been raining and stuff. It's affected I don't know if that affects it.
Oh, said, that's terrible.
He said, this time last year, he said, we were swamped with mackerel. But at the moment, and in fact, when my wife made calls, another guy said, in fact, there's not a lot of mackerel around at the moment. And that's the way it is, just, you know, the temperature and seasons.
Oh, like, you're really unlucky. Okay, well, next time you go down the coast, try again. I mean, it's definitely worth doing, because if you ever catch one and then eat it fresh on that day, it is just the best tasting fish that I have ever tasted. Absolutely brilliant. So it's worth it.
Yeah, well, we were contemplating actually getting off where the boat was, and there was a little fish hut there. We used to buy fish, and I said, let's just buy a big one and take it back to the missus and say we caught it. And but at the price, I don't know, waste my money on that anyway. But we didn't. But I tell you what is a good investment, Paul, isn't this? So we hired a beach hut. Near these beach huts, basically, you know, not larger than a garden shed, you know, pretty much. So not that much bigger than that. So this lady bought this beach hut in 1990 for $2,500. The one sold next to hers last week, I think it was, for $85,000.
Oh, I know, yeah. Just for a beach hut as well. I mean, it's absolutely crazy.
Quite nice. I mean, they are quite nice, because you can get changed in them. You've got a sort of gas-powered sort of kitchen, no running water. You can't stay in them at all. But they said all you buy, essentially, is the permission, the license to have that there. The council can come along anytime they want, knock them all down. That's you've got no rights to them. But I thought, $85,000, there are places in the valleys of South Wales where you could buy a nice terrace house for that, you know.
There aren't that many nowadays. I mean, you've actually just made a brilliant intro into a company, actually, that I've sort of run the slide rule over. It's a premium brick manufacturer called Michelmersh. And everybody's pretty aware that house prices have just gone to the moon over the last 12 months. You've had Nationwide, and you've had Rightmove all saying that you've seen 10% price increases. And remember, that sort of turned the clock back 15 months, and they were saying it's going to go down by 10%. So you've seen incredible sort of price appreciation. You've got not much sort of like stock on the market. But what's less well understood is that a lot of people, homeowners now, are going up market in terms of premiumization. So they're looking for more space If they're not moving, they're building sort of like good quality property. And this plays perfectly to Michaelmers, which, as I say, is a premium, and I mean premium, brick manufacturer. It makes differentiated, aesthetically pleasing, or, you know, appealing type of clay bricks and different sort of building products. It has about sort of 5% of the UK market. It doesn't actually compete against the major big boys like Ibstock or Forterra or Wienerberger. It tries to go, obviously, for the differentiated side. And I would class it, really, as a trophy asset-type play in the whole building products space. And I know the management team. I've actually used to invest in them as well. The product quality is great. And the strategy's worked so well that actually the biggest problem they've had the last 2 or 3 years is keeping up with demand. And they had a trading update about, I think it was about sort of 7 or 8 days ago. And they said that, you know, they're seeing really strong volumes, in fact, higher than expectations. So they'll put their interims out probably sometime in July or maybe September. But a trading statement will go out probably in July and the interims will come out in September. But I expect them to sort of like traded well. As I say, it's that whole move which is people haven't, you know, investors haven't yet really picked up on, is this premiumization. I mean, all the DIY stuff you do, you know, I bet you're putting in some quite decent materials, aren't you?
Well, listen, it's down to the wife. I did say yesterday, are we going to stop spending now on the house? Because it's been going on for like 8 weeks or something now. I mean, we've done this sort of the patio has been done. It looks very nice on black tile. There's a guy inside the house. Guy inside the house painting. There's people at the front. Part of the Green Homes grant we got as well to put some stuff on the front and some cladding and all that stuff. We've got other things done as well. Guttering we've had done. It's a brand new house almost.
And people want it to look good, because if it looks good, then the value of the property goes up. And they just generally want to sort of like, this whole COVID has made them sort of like, you know, nesting. But it isn't just domestic property. It's also things like HS2 railway stations. It's build to rent. It's the, you know, basically those big, you know, blocks of new flats that go out to young professionals. It's the foyers. It's the aesthetics of the building. And this is what people are doing now. Rather than actually just getting a standard, you know, 4x12 breeze block or something like that, they actually want something which looks good and appealing and is going to attract homeowners or actual, rented customers. And so that's happened sort of like the whole, you know, sort of like commercial as well as residential. And you've heard about the government's promise to build 300,000 new properties a year. Well, we currently build about 200,000. You could see over the next, if they ever get anywhere near that, you could see huge demand for bricks and for more premium bricks over the next decade. And it isn't easy to get planning permission to build sort of like, you know, brick factories. In fact, it's really, frankly, very difficult. And you need the clay piece. And let's be clear about it. You're not going to get too many imports because it's a sort of like a heavy volume orientated product. So they're in an absolutely perfect sweet spot here for long-term trend. And I've pointed out the shares. Okay, they've done quite well. They're about 140 at the moment. But I sort of ran the numbers, and the turnover they're looking at roundabout for this year, the best estimate for the brokers, about 55 mil. But I think in about 5 years' time, you know, it's certainly not out of the question, they could hit sort of like 100 million pounds of turnover, which if you put a 25% EBITDA, you get to a sort of like, just on a standard 10 times EBITDA multiple, you get £3.65. And that generates, if you look at a 2% dividend yield, that's sort of 14% annualized return for a patient long-term investors for a premium type of luxury product. And I know you're a very smart guy. You just go around in sort of T-shirts and stuff. But people pay more for luxury products rather than they do for brand, just standard branded products. And the same thing
what
goes
are you saying?
For
I'm looking scruffy. Is that what you're saying?
And the same thing goes for sort of like LVMH and people like that. The multiples go up. So really using a 10 times EBITDA multiple is under really sort of like valuing the business, because I think this is I come back to the first statement I made. I think this is a trophy asset that investors probably want to put on their stopwatch, because if it ever comes down, it's an absolute screaming buy. But at the moment, I mean, if you look at it, if you're long-term investors, I think it's a good 14% easily, you know, sort of compound return over the next 5 years. So it's definitely worth it. I'm hoping to touch base again with the CEO. He's been really busy, but I'm hoping to touch base over the next week or so.
Do you know what?
I'll let people know how I get on.
Yeah, do you know what? It's not a dissimilar chart to like someone like Taylor Wimpey, for example. Of course, it would be.
Yeah, another stock.
Yeah, well, do you know what? If you look at the chart, it obviously sold off with everything else in March 2020, and then went up and down, came back to that level pretty much. It was like at 80 odd pence, but then it went up to sort of £1.05, came back to like 85 pence in November, and then all of a sudden. Blast off! What did they release in November? Because something in November. What was that?
Well, that was the vaccine, wasn't it? That was basically the vaccine which stimulates like the housing market.
9th of November. Yes, that's right. Of course. Yeah, yeah.
But the other.
They did a trading update as well on the end of November as well. So maybe it helped. But it shot up then from 85 pence to pretty much up to 145, 150. Yeah.
Yeah, and the other things which are also potentially driving it, say, not just the infrastructure and new chronic shortage of houses and the premiumisation, but you've also got, you know, the potential long-term thing about redeveloping vacant shopping centres, high streets and office space. Mm-hmm. I mean, if people ever go back and go into residential, they'll have to redevelop all that stuff from COVID. And that's going to go, some of it's going to go into housing and it will go into premium looking housing. And these guys are perfectly placed. Another one is, you know, this whole thing about Grenfell with the recladding. Yeah. Well, it's got what the fire regulations say. It must be absolutely 100% fire resistant. And they're doing systems for, in fact, quite a few of the brick guys are doing systems for sort of like, you know, for recladding, because it is the best and the most fireproof and actually the most aesthetically pleasing solution for the recladding. And that's potentially a very big opportunity for them as well. So you've got so many growth drivers in that industry. And the one thing that hasn't yet come through, and they didn't actually say it in the trading, but again, it's something I want to pick the brains of. It's a co-CEO, Frank Hanna, I remember. He's a great guy. Anyway, so I want to pick the brains on his actual pricing. And what's happening is that you've seen probably, I bet you've been paying over the nose for your DIY, because you've seen people like Travis Perkins increasing cement prices by 15% and plasterboard by 10% and stuff like that. Well, brick prices yet haven't really accelerated, I don't think. I mean, I don't know, but I haven't spoken to to Frank, but I suspect they haven't, because they're under most of the sort of the big sort of volume stuff is underneath long-term contracts, well, with the distributors and stuff. But that will all come through it in due course as those contracts roll over. And when
invest in bricks and mortar, yeah?
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, I could actually see, because they've got a really good history of beating expectations. I could see them beating expectations this year. But potentially, if the market continues going and where I think it might do, with more pricing and similar or increasing demand for next year, then I could see them lifting at their expectations quite markedly for 2022 if they that price bump.
Yeah, but how sustained is this, uplift? No, what I'm saying is, no, I know, but listen, we've been spending the wife has been spending for like 8 weeks pretty much, you know, but to a certain extent, we're limited on what we can buy at the moment. Normally, that money we're spending on the house would be on holidays, you know. Now, the holiday market will come back. You know, and people will start going on holidays again. I'm not saying it'll drop off a cliff. I'm not saying that at all. But we have had pent-up demand that people want to spend on something. People are addicted to spending. And so they are spending on home improvements and moving houses and all that stuff. Will it slow down a little bit, you think, or what?
I'm sure it will. I hope it does, because it effectively the industry can't work on that sort of like pace long term. But if you assume sort of like normal sort of GDP levels, you're still getting to sort of like, and any stimulus you get from the government in terms of trying to get to this 300,000 new build houses a year, then you've got huge drivers behind the industry for new build, for repair and maintenance, and for new infrastructure.
Actually, been news from the ONS just now come out, but economy grew by 2.3% in April. Construction fell in April compared to the strong growth in the previous month, but the sector remains above pre-pandemic peak. So it's still higher than the peak pre-pandemic. So obviously,
but, look at the last big the PMIs on the UK construction at the start of the month in June. There were 64. 50, yeah. Anything above 50 indicates expansion. 64 goes, you go back to something like 1988 to get a number like that. It just says that it's on fire. It doesn't say it's increasing. It says it's absolutely ripping the road up. I mean, it's going mad.
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, so... But okay. I think... Well, just have a look at that one. I mean, I think we just... Let's just touch base on the sort of the top level, because I think something which has been certainly... puzzling me, and I think puzzling a lot of investors, in fact, a lot of big fund managers as well, is the US Treasury inflation expectations and what's happening between the bond and the equity markets. Because I don't know if you saw yesterday, Justin, but the US came out with a blowout 5% CPI, you know, inflation number, and that was above expectations. But the bond market fell, the US Treasury fell to 1.44. But the stock market went to an all-time high, and how do you reconcile that? I mean, I've got an idea. Have you got any thoughts?
Yeah, but it's about expectations, isn't it, really? We always overshoot one way or the other, and then it pulls back. But, I mean, I don't know. What's your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think what you've got is two differences of opinion. You've got your bond market guys who basically think, because the economy and the UK economy here are running so hot, it's going to trigger the central bankers to withdraw, to empty some of the punch bowl that they've been throwing into the market in terms of monetary stimulus earlier than expectations. And therefore, the bond guys are saying, because they've reduced the yields on treasuries, they're buying bonds, basically. They're saying that because that's going to happen, it's going to slow down the economy and you're going to take the juice out of the inflation figures. And therefore, bonds are becoming more attractive. The equity guys on the other side are saying this is a Goldilocks environment because the Fed is saying such that the inflation is transitory and therefore it's basically back onto that risk on trade. But what you had yesterday also the last few days in the UK is that quite a few of the cyclicals we've just talked about with Michelmersh and the house builders have actually come off all-time highs. So even though the stock market's gone to the moon, some of the cyclicals have come off. So there's been a lot of sort of like contradictions and sort of like, you know, you've got the bond market and the equity guys who are sort of butting heads. And obviously the equity guys, you've had the rotation trade back into growth and the cyclical trade has fallen out of bed a bit. But I would say, this is the important bit, okay? Forget what price action is at the moment. Just think what will happen in 2 or 3 months' time. The reason why the cyclicals in the UK have been hit is because we had news yesterday, or there's a lot of talk, that we're not going to fully reopen on the 21st of June. That's hit the short-term, just sentiment and perception of the reopening trade for restaurants, for airlines, and for, you know, the house builders and stuff like that. But we're just talking timing. We're talking 1 or 2 months here. By the end of the summer, it's going to be absolutely, you know, full bore on, you know, going forward. And on that basis, because it's just timing, if you hold some of these stocks, you know, keep them. And if you don't, then I'll take this dip as a buying opportunity and pick up some of the cheap shares, things like, you know, Michelmersh and stuff like that. Because
I say there, though, with you talking about bonds and all this is why I don't get. I see top line figures. I saw the treasuries, you know, the yields and all that stuff coming down yesterday. Don't pay too much attention to it. But this is why you are full time. You are full time into this. You literally don't sleep. And can you see someone who's trying to get, you know, make a start in the world of investing? There's lots of, even on individual stocks, and there's so many ratios, so much terminology, knowing where to start. There's so many different companies out there. And then you throw the bond markets in, and the experts don't understand what's going on, and they're studying it full time. So it's so confusing for a new investor to come in. And that's why, you know, you've got to try and keep it as simple as possible. And look at the business. It's, you know, a good business you like that's in a strong mega trend, you know, for years and years, that's improving. And try and keep it simple, because you can overcomplicate it sometimes. I bet you've been, you know, I bet you've stopped or maybe changed your mind on investment due to some macro trend. eventually didn't have any effect on something. You can get too caught up in macro and thinking, hang on, how do I keep it simple and focus on the individual company? That's what I need to do, essentially, the business, you know, the actual business I'm looking at.
All I would say is
there's so many moving parts, isn't it? So many, even for yourself there, you can be doing this 24 hours a day, and you almost do the sleep patterns you have, and then you still say, we're not quite sure what's going on. So if you don't know, how does the average Joe who's got, you know, works, say, 9 to 5 somewhere, and has to come home and look at their portfolio? I just say ignore that stuff.
All I would say is that the macro stuff, you've got to feed it in. And the key part it feeds in is valuation, because it's going to drive what level of expansion or growth you expect that particular asset you're thinking about buying.
But there are plenty of big investors who would never pay any attention to the macro. If you look, Warren Buffett says that, never pays any attention to the macro, looks at companies.
That's rubbish, Justin. That's absolute rubbish.
No, it's not.
That guy says a lot of stuff, and if you believe him on his word, then don't.
What were you calling him, Buffett, a liar?
He's a liar. He's a really brilliant investor, absolutely brilliant, but he knows the ins and outs of the macro. Most people do. Because it overlays on pricing.
A book I highly recommend, I don't know if you've read it, it's called The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. And he talks about it there, about Buffett and all that stuff, and how his investment strategy has changed over time. In fact, Benjamin Graham changed every book. Every edition he came out, he had a new formula. He said, the old one doesn't work now. And he got to the stage where the last edition of his books, he basically said, I'm not going to keep doing this because it don't work. What I'm doing doesn't work. And so he changed it all the time. So it's so complex. But Buffett, for example, one of the things he points out in this book is about the miracle of compounding. And he said that 90% of Buffett's wealth has been earned after his 50th birthday. And
how old are you, Justin?
I'm 50, yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. You got plenty going.
I'm too late. But and also, I don't know if most of the money's been made on, and this is sometimes having conviction in a stock, you know, and having too many stocks. And like I said, you won't get anywhere sometimes because they've made most of their money on 10 of the biggest investments. Charlie Munger said, in fact, if we took those 10 big investments out, we would have average returns. And so what I'm saying is, try and find a research individual business. There's so many moving parts to look at. You could look at bonds, you could look at gold, you could look at all different kind of things. And essentially, it'll get so complicated. You'll have option paralysis and you get so wound up and stressed up, you don't want to be able to make a decision. So I just think, look at businesses that are in long-term trends, you know, big up trends, and just research from
there. Yeah, but okay, the key thing is
ignore the macro.
Keep it simple for investors, okay?
No, but you don't, though. You complicate it. And good at it.
No. I'm just going to give you a rule of thumb. A rule of thumb to keep it simple, if you don't want to get into the top level macro stuff, into the micro detail of it, essentially, is basically to ask yourself, is the macro movement long term, secular, or noise and transitory? If it's the latter, which is the 80%, 80, 90% of
even
the time.
Even that question isn't simple. You say keep it simple.
No, it is. Just ask yourself. Is this short term?
Anything is like subjective sometimes. Even as we know, these days, fake facts come out. What is true? You get so many people on Twitter pushing their agendas. There's gold bulls, there's crypto bulls, there's bond guys. And you think, what is actually true here? You know, what is actually true? And the macro trends, because you can read top line. We read stuff all the time about COVID, and we've realized now 6 months online, that wasn't true. And so, so how do you know what is true? So I mean, you can't, you know, as I said, it's hard to know, isn't it? You know, and whether it will have an effect.
I'll give you one more thing.
We've had forecasters famously wrong year after year after year, and we still listen to them. We still give them airtime. And they, why? And some of the most successful investors about this one guy, I'll get his name up though, but he's one of the best fund managers in the world. And he said, you know, going back over it, I wouldn't have paid any attention to macro. I was too worried about recessions coming, too worried about it. I should just concentrate on businesses. That's what I should have gone to. And that's where, and worry about, you know, taking money out, putting money back in, that messing around.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, something is true, right? Okay. You know, I talked about, I think about 2 or 3 weeks ago, a company to put on the stock watch, Avintraz. Well, they came out with a fabulous contract win with Sellafield. Avintraz, AVG is the ticker. Yeah. And I said to people, just stick this, have a good look at it. And this again, they're knocking the ball out of the park. One of their divisions makes ultra-secure, high-integrity steel boxes for nuclear decommissioning sites. And they've won a contract, and its extension goes to another £20 million, it goes to £70 million with Sellafield for the long-term decommissioning of this. And I mean, just to give you an indication, these are really sort of like secure containers. I mean, they've got to last in the ground when they store intermediate nuclear material for 500 years. That's five centuries. So not many people can build these sort of things. And this is in the context. So a sort of total absolute contract value of 70 mil over the year, over years. But this is in the context of their sales is only about 100 million. So it's quite material. But the key read across here is, one, it's a massive endorsement from a world-leading customer. Two, it's a long life use of their product. So this is not going away anytime soon. This, you know, nuclear decommissioning is something which is going to last decades. Three, there's international opportunities because Sellafield's not the only nuclear authority in the world that potentially could take these and has to decommission. And four, it's showcasing their technology to, you know, basically to other potential customers. So it's a huge contract, gives them great revenue visibility. And on the back of that, I've actually upgraded my, I had a very modest valuation of £4.70, I think it was, a couple of weeks or two or three weeks ago. And the shares, I think, are on £3.70 today. But I've upgraded that to over £5, of actually £5.07. And again, I still think that's modest. And I would flag it that, you know, learn from great investors. And I picked this stock up originally from Christopher Mills of Harwood Capital, who I rated absolutely right at the top of the tree of small and medium cap. We've also got Simon Thompson, Investors Chronicle, who's also, you know, top-notch small cap investor. And the other guy I spoke to recently, which really sort of tipped the bucket, tipped me, you know, to have a really, really strong look at it, was James Thorne of Columbia Threadneedle. So I think this is, you know, got a lot of runway ahead of it. One, because of those type of contracts. And the other one, I mean, another type of long-term contract. One of their other divisions, Booth, make blast-proof doors, which I mentioned last time. And these go into things like, you know, HS2 tunnelling. And again, that's a £36 million contract over a number of years. And it's showcasing their niche engineering technology. And I think they're sort of like split 55% product and 45% higher margin aftermarket. And these things are just long life products. And the other thing to note about the whole business is they're now cashed up because they sold their Peter Brotherhood division for 35 million. Gives them about just over 20 million of spare cash. Plus they're selling some land in Luton, which will probably bring 10 million, net 10 million extra. And this management team has demonstrated a track record of sort of like buying businesses, integrating them, massively improving them. And then if they get the price is right, to actually sell them on. And if you actually run the numbers and look at the share price, Justin, and you talk about long-term investments, these guys have delivered nearly 20% compound average share price return over the last decade. I mean, that is just, that's Warren Buffett type. So they're a capable management team. And the products are great. I mean, we're talking niche, so not many competitors. Ultra, you know, products that hit sort of like regulated, highly challenging environments need to be safety critical. So it's blast-proof doors. It's high-integrity nuclear storage boxes, but it's also sort of like high performance pumps and motors as well. So it's a
When you said that, what they do, I thought, wow, how many people do that? And exactly. It's so specialist. But of course, is the demand there? Then you look at the contracts. Yes, demand is there. So you think that kind of thing there. Like you said, that is what Buffett says. A moat is not many people can do that. And
And that's not even mentioning their new sort of like division in the medical side, and they're trying, and this is, they're not far off actually, creating or developing a breakthrough small form cryogen free MRI scanner in their Magnetica division. And if they can actually bring that to market, that is just a massive value and generator. And that's in the price for absolutely nothing at the moment, because the valuation I gave is largely just on the existing business, and this is just free. So you know, you get that as a potential optionality onto it. And it's amazing, really, because most MRA scanners, if you ever had to have one or know a friend, they're big things, they're gantries, and you go down and you have to basically be in it for like 40 minutes. You have to stick on headphones and headset because you see they have all these noises going around you. But this is small form, and it's aimed at neonatal, so babies and very young children, plus on the vet side. But it's a £400 million plus market, total addressable market, that's really untapped at the moment. So they've got some really neat technology there that, if that does come to market, that gives them a lot of optionality. They can either go for it, they can either partner with a bigger medical device manufacturer, or and license the technology, or even, you know, try and actually bring it to market themselves. So
market cap wise, what, 116 million, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I mean, it's absolute, you know, buttons. So,
and so that's the thing you said, they've got a guarantee 500 years. And if it doesn't work, you get your money back after 500 years, do you?
Say that again.
They say you've got to build those steel boxes. They've got to be worthy for 500
exactly.
years.
Yeah, exactly. 500 years.
If you keep your receipt, it doesn't work. Can you get your money back after 500 years? Wow, that's amazing. 500 years.
I know, guaranteed. Yeah, it's got to be for 5 centuries, exactly. I mean, that is just phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah, wow. I know. Cool. Anything else happening?
I mean, the other bit of big news was actually Avacta earlier this week announced that it actually been given final approval by MHRA, which is the UK authority, to sell its rapid lateral flow test for professional use in the UK. And that's a big rubber stamp of the technology, of their Affima technology that's used in the diagnostics and the reagents for that rapid lateral flow. It's one, if not the most accurate test in the world, I believe, for rapid lateral flows. And
Did the price come off a bit on that? Is that what happened?
What's interesting is such that, because with the vaccination programs in the US and UK are going so well, people keep asking and questioning whether you're ever going to need, you know, sort of testing going forward. And I just say to them, look at what's happening currently in places like Bolton. In fact, we're increasing our testing, or at least staying flat in the UK. It's roughly around about 1 million, you know, tests a day, if you look at it across lateral flow and PCR. And that's using old technology. This lateral flow that they've got is to say, for picking up people who are infectious, not just necessarily infected, but infectious, then it's absolutely essential. So I see it, once the world, and this is going to take at least, let's be clear about it, it's going to take at least to the end of 2022 before the world is fully vaccinated.
I was thinking that you've got to have the majority of the world vaccinated before you can be safe and not
exactly,
worry
about because you're going to get massive, you're getting all these variants. Okay, but let's just assume.
I think our perception is biased because our country is doing very well on the vaccination front. We assume other people are, or some countries are nowhere near where we are.
They haven't even started, have they?
I know, some 10%. Yeah, yeah.
They haven't even started. So let's just assume we're in 2023 now, and let's hope and pray that the world has been fully vaccinated. Right now, going forward, we're still going to get variants because, as I've talked about, and I keep banging the table on about this, there's lots and lots of people with compromised immune systems. This thing is going to incubate in those people, and this is 3% of the world's population. So we're still going to see variants. Now, where we get a variant coming through, and let's assume also that in 2023 people want to go on a foreign holiday. And they want to go to foreign business meetings. So you're going to get basically people can cross contamination. We're going to start opening the borders worldwide. I mean, that's a bigger leap of faith, but I hope we do get there. On that basis, we are going to get these variants transmitting. So let's just assume the vaccines largely protect the people who have got normal immune systems. And therefore, we don't see a surge in hospitalizations from that category, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, on that basis, then NHS should be fine and we should be able to bring down some of the waiting lists. However, for those poor people, which is about 200 million to 300 million people, the 3% of the world's population who have got compromised immune systems, there was a big study which came into the Wall Street Journal, which reported 2 weeks ago from the John Hopkins Institute. You've probably heard about it because they report all the COVID stats. So this is a major study. These are not sort of like, you know, types of me and you boys just doing the study. These guys have got scientific credibility. They came out And they did an assessment of patients who have got compromised immune systems. 50% of them, after a double dose of the MRI vaccines, did not have a single antibody protection. So I'll repeat that. Two jabs, they had no protection from COVID, and we're talking 200 to 300 million people around the world. So if you have transmission, yeah, going around the world, you will also need identification of people who still have, who are infectious with COVID, to alert these people, the 200 to 300 million people, that they could come in contact. So where we have, you'll still need a lot of lateral flow testing and PCR testing to essentially to identify those people who are infectious but won't be hospitalized, like me and you, who can transmit it to the people who are going to die from COVID, which is the 200 to 300 million people. So yes, you won't get the peaks of the testing, but you'll still, ongoing from 2023 onwards, need COVID testing to protect those people who are going to effectively die or end up in hospital. And that is
I got to say, I think what will happen as well, when testing goes down anyway, the best providers, top quality providers, yes, of the test will be the ones that exist and still survive and thrive in this environment, because a lot of these companies will drop by the wayside. But even though, you know, I look at that, it sounds a lot, and it is a lot of people, of course, 300 million, but as a percentage of the population, have a guess what that percentage is.
As I say, it's the world's population. It's about 3 or 4%, isn't it?
No, 0.003%.
There's 7.4 billion people.
7.98 billion, close to. I'd say 300 million by.
But it's a lot of people. It's 10 million just in the US. So it's a lot of people. But you raise a very good point. Yeah. The people will adopt the best quality test on terms of accuracy, ease of use, cost.
And you're right, 3.75%. Sorry, you're right, 3.75%.
So basically, they'll adopt the best test on above their attributes. Right up there. Now, what's really interesting, that you just raised a fantastic point there, is the DHSC, okay? Mm-hmm. They announced this week, or a couple of weeks ago, that they've delayed their decision of their go-to provider for lateral flow tests. They should have done it like 2 months ago. Now, because they've delayed it, I don't know, it's probably wishful thinking for Avacta investors, but it's a bit of a coincidence that Avacta have only just got their MHRA, you know, approval, and the DHS haven't made a decision on who their lead lateral flow test is. I could be putting two and two, you know, together to get the wrong result here, but that just seems a massive leap of, you know, coincidence, given the urgency we need. I think they were definitely wanting Avacta's technology within their decision complex before nominating their go-to provider. Anyway,
you've got to go best in class. You've got to go.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you're going to miss so many people who are infected, the problem will persist. So you've got to go best in class.
That's and the other thing also to note is as such that. You know, I talked about my investments in Merck and Gilead. Okay, well, Merck had a really interesting piece of news this week. I think it was a couple of weeks ago. It came out. They got an order from the U.S. health authorities for $1.2 billion. Yeah, to basically make, I think it was something like 1.5 million doses of their new antiviral for COVID. And I talked about therapeutics and this sort of stuff. They're doing trials at the moment, but they're buying ahead because they believe this got a good chance of actual working, and the results should come out in the second half. This could be another blockbuster for them, but priced at roughly around about $700 per dose to the US government. If they're doing it, these guys are not idiots, okay, the US government. And you could imagine, you know, other governments are going to pre-order as well, because I think this could be an absolute home run for Merck. And don't forget, Gilead's obviously still got Remdesivir, but they're right in this whole area of creating therapeutics. And you'll like the vaccines, you'll need 5 or 6 therapeutics that actually work around the world. So that could be really good news if we do get a therapeutic that works and is out in the market by the end of the year. But again, it's going to be swamped by demand, because frankly, if you've got 200 to 300 million people every single year going into hospital because they're going to be, you know, infected, then You know, you're gonna need a blockbuster therapeutic, a blockbuster load of testing, and blockbuster vaccines that you tweak every 6 to 12 months to protect the world and allow us to get back to anywhere near normal, to start reducing these hospitalization waiting lists. And did you see that number this week?
Yeah. Was it 5 million, man?
5.1 million. And that's without the testing over the last 12 months of people who have got symptoms but didn't want to go into hospital, or the hospitals haven't been able to test them. It's probably about 6 million. I mean, it's enormous. I feel sorry for them. I really do. But just think about it. If you had 6 million people who need, you know, some sort of like elective surgery or some sort of like help from the hospitals, we're talking 8% of the UK population. That is frankly massive. What is the NHS going to do? And that's going to work to the advantages, as I've said before, to companies like, you know, the healthcare services companies. So Source Bio should do really well. Totally should do really well. I mean, there's a list as long as your arm. But hey,
Let me ask you a question on a personal level. When you're looking at stocks and looking to invest, where do you start? Because your stock, I know you look at sectors sometimes, but you look at, you know, they're having a sort of...
You know what I'm going to say, Justin? You're asking for a kicking.
I know, but hang on. I love a kicking from you, Paul. It's a hobby I choose to take part in. But because if you look at your portfolio, there's big companies, US companies, UK companies, small companies, microcap almost. So where do you start? Because there's so many options out there, opportunities. So where do you start? Where do you start looking? I mean, you know, because you were talking, I base myself in the UK alone in microcaps pretty much. So I limit my base and the filters are away. But you are including the US as well. So you're talking sort of thousands and thousands of companies. So how do you start looking? What do you start searching for?
The bond market. And macro.
I'm pulling your leg.
No, I look at secular trends. I'm not that dissimilar to you, Justin. Trends, So for instance, going forward, my two most favoured sectors are healthcare and technology, because they have long-term tailwinds. Healthcare, because I think we've absolutely entered that golden era of new technology in it, like, you know, med tech, telemedicine. I mean, that'll play to people like Trellis Health, for instance. So, you know, that whole area of new technology, but also accelerated regulatory approvals and huge waiting lists to go through. And then effectively the software side of it is just fabulous, because moving into the cloud now, everything's going, you know, digitization and everything of all the corporates and enterprise systems. Those are the two biggest trends. And then the third biggest trend is going to be infrastructure around the world, because, you know, we need to repair things, we need new housing and all that kind of stuff. And the governments are not going to sort of like take the foot off the gas when it comes to sort of like, you know, getting, you know, that sorted to keep the economy going. So those are the industries that I would do, where you have very good barriers to entry and long-term tailwinds, significant IPR and higher margins. I mean, that's...
I saw someone ask you about actually RDT, Roslyn Data Technologies. Are you still holding those?
I've spoken to the CEO about 2 weeks ago, Paul Watts. He's fabulous, absolutely fabulous. He's one of the best CEOs I've come across. He's one of the best CEOs that I've come across ever in a small cap. He's absolutely brilliant. So I'm keeping my money with him. I really am. I mean, I haven't bought any more, but I certainly haven't sold. I think that has got a lot of upside. If he does what I think he'll do, and I've actually exchanged emails with the chairman who's really positive on Paul as well, and the rest of the board are really positive on Paul, I think that business will do really, really well. You've got to give him a bit of time, because the whole digitization side, that, you know, because of lockdowns, has been pushed to the right. But I think sort of the back end of this year, early next year, you'll start seeing a real acceleration in contract momentum. So, yeah, when it comes to Roslyn Data Technology, I've not sold any at all. And I'm a long-term holder of that business. And I've got no view of selling them, because I think, and if anything, if I had more spare cash, it's one I would pick more shares up, because I would strongly recommend anybody who's serious, have a chat to Paul if you can, because he's a great guy. I mean, you'll be, you know, the guy is dead passionate. He comes from Blue Prism, And he's dead passionate about the business. He's really committed. And he's got great ideas of how to actually, you know.
Another passionate Paul.
Paul, but
the funny thing is, with trading updates, people, you know, a lot of time it happens all the time, you know, markets mark them down after a trading update, but it's historical news, you know, we know that, and the company's looking forward and moved on. And sometimes, I think a lot of times, that's an opportunity to pick up, you know, after a trading update or financial report, which is looking backwards, and especially in 2020, where abnormal year completely, you know, that is an opportunity a lot of times, isn't there? Sometimes I just say, if you're a research company, wait until there are the finals, because in a year like last year, it'll dip and you can pick them up.
I would say, just for me, you know, because it's quite difficult for me to buy large chunks of small cap stocks. And the way I picked up my original stake was a couple of years back in, you know, and one of the fund managers just did a cross trade and managed to pick up a big load of shares all in one go. But when if I buy and put a reasonable sum into it, there's no volume. I couldn't do it. But for smaller investors, then you've got an opportunity. And as you say, you know, my portfolio is mega cap, US, UK, and this is a real micro. And I can't remember what the actual market cap is, but I bet you it's not more than about 20 mil.
No.
So it's a real sort of selection. But I think the long term trajectory. If I was going to say, you know, sort of like my top small caps for going forward, is Equals, the e-payments Forex business. I think that's got a great runway ahead of it. Northbridge, which is putting out its, hopefully, an AGM trading update on Tuesday. And I'm touching base with the chairman. Again, I've got a big position in that. And I think they're in a fabulous situation to really do well. And also Rosslyn, and, you know, and that's on the assumption that Paul can actually really sort of drive that business. And when I spoke to him, I think he's doing a fabulous job at the moment. What you can't see is the value that's already been created, because it doesn't reflect in the share price and isn't reflected in the turnover coming through. But that will, in my view, come through. It's just a matter of time, not when. Yeah.
No, you've got to give time. It's funny, in that book actually gives us stats of making money, and it said historical gains on stock markets. And literally, you've got a 50-50 chance, and I think it's less than actually, of making money on day trades. Go up to a year, 68% chance. Go up to 10 years, 88% chance of making money. 20 years, 100% chance of making money historically in the stock market in the UK, in the US. I don't know what's based on, maybe in indices. But talk about drop opportunities, and this is a Pete, my friend of mine, to talk about opportunities where it drops. And Truefin, the company I hold, and they're holding, they have four companies, one's a gaming, three fintech. Satargo, which connected to Lloyds, which you hold. They're sort of invoicing, sort of financing company, automated for small companies, and they're a lot more effective, again, paid from big employers. So they did a trial with Lloyds back in December the 11th, 6 months trial, and it came up, obviously, it's now the 11th of the day. So yesterday announced it'd been extended, and people, what's that? And so there's a bit of worry there. And if you look at the last statement, the guy from Lloyds didn't sound like it was a trial at all. He said, we're best in class software, we're taking it forward. You know, only Truefin said it was a trial. But if you look now, people worry it dropped off yesterday about 6%. I think, read the RNS. And sometimes it's in the detail, and I think it's just a bit of COVID delay, essentially. But it's going strong, the trial is going strong. And I don't think that they've announced another 6 month trial. I don't think it'll take 6 months. But if you read it, the second line in there says, both parties are keen to work closely and continue the commercial pilot in which the target will develop further integrations with the bank's infrastructure and drive additional reach through Lloyds regional sales network. That, to me, that's an improvement on the last. I mean, the people are so impatient now. They're like, they didn't sign it, I'm out. And like, whoa, hang on a sec. You can't just hold on for a couple of months and jump out when something doesn't go wrong. But I think sometimes when the share price drops like that and you read into it a bit more, I think there's opportunities, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, can you actually, as an investor, can you actually join that trial? Can you actually test the tech?
Obviously Satargo is standalone. It's not exclusive to Lloyds. They've white labeled it.
But, well, that's what you should do then. Download the tech and give it, kick the tires on it.
If you look at the last statement, that Lloyds are happy with it. It's going to get done. It's just a bit of delay. You know, big companies like Lloyds.
Yeah, no, I would agree.
Like the big companies are like super tankers, aren't they? They start slow, moving slow, and once they get going, it's fine. And it's just nothing ever. It's like you take delays all the time in business. It happens, especially.
All I would say is that if you put yourself in Lloyds' position, and this is really stuff that they want, which is frankly sounds as though it is, okay. you're probably the reason for the delay. And again, I'm putting two and two and getting five here, okay? And it may be wishful thinking. But you wouldn't, if you were Lloyds, you wouldn't want to announce you'd signed a contract and the value of that business to increase, that part of the business, if you wanted to buy it. You would be entering negotiations to buy that business now with the intention of then said, you know, basically signing later on. So all I would say is that commercially wise...
Do you know what? Oddly, the in my Share Pickers Investment Club, there's a guy in there whose brother-in-law owned this. He had to sell it when he didn't, he'd run out of cash financing it. He loved it, and a lot of people loved it. And he asked him about this. He said exactly the same thing. He said, they're probably doing due diligence on this.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. if that is what they want, then... Lloyds will be mad to sign a contract, announce it, and then buy it later on at a higher price. They'll be doing it at the same time.
Yeah.
Anyway, potentially good news for you, Justin.
Yeah, it's a bit of patience, that's all. I mean, there's other parts of the business as well. They're all at inflection points, actually, all now starting to become EBITDA sort of positive. So it's very good for the company. They've got, you know, tons of cash, like 17 million in cash. They're valued at 65 million. They've got four companies there. So I think it's just one of those things you have to wait a little bit, you know, so a bit of time. But cool. Anything else? So we all do.
No. All I would say to investors is keep your eyes peeled on the macro and the bond market.
Listen, what you need to do is actually just 172. You just listen to what Paul says in the macro. That's fine. And you just concentrate on your shares. Let Paul do the hard work. Put the hard yards in and listen to what he has to say. And he'll take the hard work out of it for you. That's fine. Marvelous. Thanks.
Fabulous. Have a great week. Best of luck with the macro fishing next time.
Yeah. Did you say macro fishing or macro?
Macro.
Freudian slip there. Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Trufin. That's TRU. I did discuss that with Paul in the podcast. At four, Tirupati Graphite. Down 2% to, what was it, 118.5. Is that a good rise recently? At three, Allergy Therapeutics, of course. I had Vadim talking about those on the podcast yesterday. AGY ticker down 1% to 25.5. At two, Clinigen down, well, just hardly down at all, but 580 is the price there. And biggest, most followed company, I should say, is Omega Diagnostics, up 4%, just over to 73 pence. It's time to check out the most read RNSs. They are as follows. At five, Predator Oil and Gas, MOU1 Drilling. At four, IQAI Limited, awarded GAD-free patent. At three, Open Orphan, exercises warrants. At two, Powerhouse Energy, Sweco to support Powerhouse technology in Poland. And at one, Avacta, registration of FEDX lateral flow tests in EU. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.